end of the week edition of the pod here. Got some news to get to. Also going to talk about that Sixers-Cavs game, which I thought was really fascinating on a number of levels. The Sixers pulling it out with aplomb against a Cavs team that really struggled from downtown. Sponsored today by Audible. Go to audible.com/catspace to start a 30-day trial with your first audiobook free. Let's hit the news first here. And where I wanted to start was some interesting news reported by Jonathan Givony that the NBL, the Australian Pro League, you'll recall that Terrence Ferguson, now of the Thunder, played there last year, became the 21st overall pick when he did not want to or could not perhaps go to college. And the idea here is that they're going to create something called the Next Stars program. They'll add an extra roster spot strictly for draft eligible players, and those players will get $100,000 Australian, which will be funded directly by the league. There's a number of things that are interesting about this. One is you used to only be able to have three foreign players per team, and it didn't really make sense to waste a spot on an untested teenager. The Adelaide 36ers actually won the NBL last year, and Ferguson didn't play much of a role. He only averaged 4.6 points. It wasn't really a part of that. They won anyway, and they developed him well, but this now provides an incentive with this extra roster spot. And do you think, Danny, that this will be an option for more U.S. teenagers?
I think it will be, but the swing factor here, as it is in almost all of these, are shoe companies, because the money that they're offering is about $78,000 U.S., which is, you know, it's not terrible, but it's not great. But shoe companies, and this, Givony talked about this in the piece, can be a very important element, was with Emmanuel Mudiay when he went to China, was for Terrence Ferguson there. And so if they decide to kind of, if they're like, hey, either we're game with this or even we want to encourage this, then it becomes much more viable. And I think there's a very reasonable chance of that. And also, you talked about how Terrence Ferguson, you know, he didn't play a whole lot for them. There are a series of complicated elements towards having these guys in the G League, because as the G League is being formed at this moment, they're trying to do more of a minor league system. And so then the players who are a part of their system will get priority versus ones that they have zero control over, because they will have to go through the draft process, because everybody has to go through the draft process.
Yeah, in the G League right now, there's no incentive to develop a player who's not really in your system, especially a young one who even in the G League is unlikely to win games. If you want to hear more about our opinions on that, we talked about that with Dylan Murphy on Monday night's show, former G League coach and scout. So he had a very good idea of kind of what it's like for guys that young trying to play in the G League. And his opinion was that it really has to kind of be beefed up. And in a way, this arrangement with the NBL could be an impetus for the NBA to ultimately do that, and also to create some incentives to develop these players. The big reason... Yeah, go ahead.
Have I ever told you my idea on how I would approach this if I were the NBA with the G League?
No.
I would establish two, probably, it would depend on the number who were interested, extra teams that were basically the kind of the equivalent of barnstorming teams, with the idea being that they are a part of the G League, they are funded by the NBA itself with coaches and stuff, so they're on their own teams rather than that they're a part of it. And so I think that would be a really interesting opportunity for that. So they would be separate from the other teams, but competing with them all the same. Maybe you put them in cities where there are not G League teams but could support it. It could be a nice little thing, even for test things, like St. Louis, let's say. You could do something there, all sorts of places. And that way you create it where they're competing, they get to stay in the U.S., they can make whatever the wage level is, but they are not intermingled, because the intermingling is the problem with the incentives as they structured the G League.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I think something along those lines as well. I mean, you'd have to get some vets on those teams, otherwise they'd just get their asses kicked. But you'd have to come up with some way to make them competitive and make it more of a real team, instead of just like, let's throw all these potential draft picks on there, because those guys are all going to be competing with each other for shots and minutes as well. But yeah, I think something along those lines could work. So getting back to the point that I was making, the reason I think that this is really interesting and could provide an impetus in the type of direction we're talking about for the G League is this is first and foremost for a low revenue league in the NBL, a way to make some money, and that follow the model with Ferguson. We wondered, hey, Ferguson, like, why would they bring this guy over when he's probably not going to really contribute? I mean, is it just for the publicity? Yeah, okay, a little bit. But in the NBL, you know, the best players, to my understanding, are making maybe $200,000 or $300,000 per year. You know, some of the lower end guys are making just, you know, like $50,000 or something like that, like not very much. And so the idea that, hey, you know what, like, we're gonna spend all this money enough to entice someone like a Ferguson to come over here, but he's not actually gonna help us win, and he's probably not really gonna help us draw and pay for himself, wealth, what's the financial incentive to do that, right? Like these are money-making organizations here. Especially if you're not going to win games, there has to be a financial incentive. Well, it all goes back to the fact that NBA teams on their own can pay up to this year $700,000 to buy a player out of his contract. And so probably what ended up happening at first, and I don't know exactly how much he got bought out for, but you remember actually there was that delay with him actually signing his contract with the Thunder. And this is speculation, but I would posit that perhaps his buyout and the amount of it had something to do with that. But his contract, most overseas contracts have a buyout amount in there if they go on longer than the amount of time. And Ferguson apparently went on longer than just that 1 year with his contract. And so the 36ers developed Ferguson for a year. He gets drafted, and now they get a nice little windfall, which is far more than his salary. It's almost just a money-making scheme. They get a financial reward for having nurtured this guy for a year and developed him. And while I think that is really nice in theory, I think that it could encourage this extra roster slot would be great. They could encourage these guys to develop. They have incentive to develop them because if they get drafted by the NBA, now you can get that buyout amount. Eventually, I think the NBA is going to kind of not be too happy about this arbitrage. And essentially, if they're going to pay $700,000 or whatever it is, and to just be subsidizing the development of these players in Australia, which is essentially what would be happening, you might as well just pay that amount of money and subsidize it in the U.S. instead and actually have control over the players. And so if a lot of players, we don't know how many players are going to start doing this. We don't know what the reaction is going to be from some of the shoe companies or agents or whatever to who might help subsidize players a little bit for a year. But I think that if enough players start doing this and enough NBA teams are like, why are we paying these guys $700,000 in a buyout? You might see a groundswell like, all right, let's just develop these guys here.
As somebody who used to make his living doing arbitrage, there are firm responses when people think they can try to make that money back. And in my business, that's a conversation that we shouldn't have on this podcast, but it's definitely something that happens. The other part with Australia that I think is worth mentioning are the cultural differences that I think would make it easier. Yes, there is a big geographic distance. I mean, Australia is a long way from here, but they speak English, and the quality of play and the structure of the league there is very different. I think back to Brandon Jennings playing for Roma or some of the other Americans that have gone abroad when they were really young. And I think Australia makes a lot of sense for that if the U.S. doesn't have their shit together, which they absolutely should. I think it makes more sense than any of the other options that are out there for most guys who are not already accustomed to that system.
Yeah. Well, the one way in which I agree with you, except for we've seen Moutier, we've seen Brandon Jennings, although I think those days are over. I think teams now have a better understanding that like players that young aren't going to help a professional team win if it's any kind of a decent level. And by the way, the NBL is actually a lower level than, you know, China probably is, although China's weird because they have all these rules about when Americans can play and stuff, and some of the higher level European leagues as well. And still get some good press and hopefully maybe help them build up their business a little bit and get more fans and all that stuff. But, you know, so maybe younger players who are really good could make more of a difference there, but you're still playing against men. Unlikely that they're going to help much on the floor. So if there are other leagues where that are willing to pay more than the NBL can, then maybe we'll see players go there instead. But it does seem like just from a development standpoint, as long as those huge contracts in like China or in Europe aren't there anymore, and maybe they aren't anymore because those players haven't really helped those teams win, then this could end up being the best option. And I mean, I applaud this because I think that players should have as many options as possible. I think the NCAA is pretty sorry, but at least it will allow players to get paid earlier. I'm not sure necessarily if Australia is going to do a better job developing players than the NCAA would. They certainly have a lot of advantages in terms of just their facilities and stuff like that at the NCAA level, although certainly the game in Australia is closer to what's being played in the NBA. But anything else on that, or should we move on?
Well, we can transition from that into a player who might have been able to do that had it been an option, especially with his eventual eligibility stuff, Shabazz Muhammad. Shabazz Muhammad, though they didn't find out about his age issues until he was getting ready for the draft as opposed to while he's playing UCLA, he was the last buyout. It was somewhat surprising because he has a player option on that last year, and we haven't heard yet how much money he gave up. But even in some ways more surprising than that there was a buyout was that he already has a destination, and I'm not thrilled about it.
This is like, it's ironic that he's going from the Wolves to the Bucks, because on the Wolves, he was on a team that had a billion shot creators already and didn't need his shot creation and absolutely nothing else type type of game. And now he's going to a Bucks team that has plenty of shot creators already and doesn't need his shot creation and nothing else game.
Yeah, and I mean, to compound with that on the nothing else part of it, Muhammad has been atrocious defensively for his entire professional career. He doesn't pass the ball, notorious for it. And you can use the eye test, you can use stats. I believe he's second to last in RPM this year, a whopping 494th. And the eye test isn't much better. I mean, he didn't look like an NBA player. He has been out of the Wolves rotation. He didn't even play in meaningful minutes, as I recall, after Jimmy Butler got hurt, and they're looking for depth in the worst way on the wing. So the fact that the Bucks decided to say, this is our guy, and hey, we need to, you know, we'll get him and he'll be playoff eligible and all that, is an absolute misstep for me from Milwaukee. And it's sad because I want every team to put the best foot forward, and I don't think Shabazz Muhammad is anybody in the NBA's best foot.
Yeah, and even if this is going to be a multi-year deal, which it may be, you'll recall that Muhammad had a player option for next year, and it'll be fascinating to see how much of that he gave up to get his freedom shortly before the Bucks will move on from Sean Kilpatrick, another shot creator that they didn't really have much need for. And I mean, this isn't the end of the world. Muhammad's a talented guy. This is kind of a second draft sort of move, but just any team other than the Bucks, and especially if he plays over someone like, say, Sterling Brown, who is looked like he could be effective as a 3-and-D type of option going forward here, that would be a mistake, I believe, as well. Even playing him over Jason Terry, I think, would be a mistake at this point. So maybe they're just keeping him around, get a look at him, see. But even next year, it's hard to imagine with all the guys they have on this team that there would be much of a role for Muhammad unless he very significantly changes his game. Other news, this happened after we recorded yesterday. Trevor Booker is the wavy for the Sixers. In fact, they already signed Ersan Ilyasova. We'll talk about his effect against Cleveland tonight later on here. Booker will sign with the Pacers for the remainder of the season, so he's actually going to make more money as a result of being waived. And certainly, I applaud Philly for being, I think this was the right move to move on from Booker with the superior option, Ilyasova, available. You thought maybe they wouldn't, just because of the PR aspect, having traded a second round pick to get Booker earlier this season. And so that's good that they recognize that sunk cost, but they also made a move that changed him into a sunk cost, and he really was ineffective in his time with Sixers.
I also think that the Pacers did reasonably well here. Booker is imperfect, but they have a little bit more shooting, especially with Miles Turner at the five, so the four is his limitations there don't necessarily compound it as much, and because they presumably didn't have Ersan Ilyasova available. Now, I would rather have Ilyasova than Booker for the Pacers as well as the Sixers, so if they could have gotten him, they should have, but he's still better than who they had. They'd been kind of TJ Leaf and some other stuff, and so Booker, they had an open roster spot. I think he makes them better, so it's a cascading type of thing. I think both teams benefited, though it's more important to a degree for the Sixers because the fit is, it was just not good with Booker there.
Yeah, and great job by Ilyasova to sign that deal where he had the no trade, avoid getting traded, and then go back to where he apparently wanted to be again, which was Philly. And supposedly, with both of these buyouts, both Bellinelli, who knew Brett Brown from his time in San Antonio, and then Ilyasova, who had spent time, of course, with the Sixers as recently as last season, Brett Brown apparently was a big factor in getting them to go there per the TNT broadcast. And it'd be interesting to see for the Pacers, are they going to be better? I haven't had a chance to watch them yet since GR3 came back, but would they play him at the four more, or is it better to play Booker? Presumably it's going to be Booker. The combinations there will be very interesting. I think, like you, I think he might fit a little bit better with Miles Turner, but if Turner is the starter, that becomes difficult to get to that combination, perhaps. Corey Brewer is going to sign with the Thunder after getting bought out by the Lakers. We talked already about why we're not huge fans of that move. If he's going to actually play, if he's just deep bench depth and leadership and all that, okay, but you imagine he's being signed there to play. What else we got here?
One thing that happened, I think it was right around when we recorded the last time, was the announcement that Josh Hart has a broken bone in his left hand, and now it's been announced that he's going to undergo surgery on his broken left finger. We do not have a timeline yet, but I would expect it'll be at least close to the end of the regular season, the Lakers aren't making the playoffs as well as they played recently. So that's certainly unfortunate. I was really looking forward to seeing how Hart fit with these young guys, especially now that Lonzo is back. And now we're probably not going to get to see that until Summer League, and we don't even know how many of these guys are going to play in Summer League.
Yeah, too bad. I enjoyed Hart, but obviously they didn't miss him too much today as they just blew out Miami. They've had a couple of impressive blowout wins lately, and that's really you don't see bad teams. They can get lucky in a lot of close games with the Lakers. I mean, they blew out the Mavs, I think, recently. I think it was the Mavs, right, who they played it earlier this week, and then to go in and just kill Miami on the back of some hot three-point shooting and Isaiah Thomas in particular going off for them, Julius Randle as well in the first half. So Memphis, we talked about them yesterday, about the young cores, that they would probably be the team with the least talent if you had to assemble a quote-unquote young core of any team in the NBA, if not the worst, certainly right up there. And Tyreke Evans has a right rib injury. He's got rib cage cartilage damage per an MRI, and certainly the Grizz have absolutely zero reason to bring him back any earlier than when he's 190% healthy. They have lost 11 straight, zooming near the top of the lottery, and because they just can't score at all without Evans on the floor, missing him might even be a bigger deal than if they miss Gasol for any reason. And then Wayne Selden's been in and out of the lineup with recurrence of those right knee issues, that quad tendon. Chandler Parsons has an illness. He's missed a few games again now. Deontay Davis sprained his ankle. He's not going to play on Friday against the Nuggets either. And basically, Andrew Harrison, their backup point guard, who's actually been better than expected this year, is questionable for Friday. I mean, they are just walking wounded. And Marc Gasol expressed some frustration, but this is what it's going to be for the rest of the year, man. So get used to it. The Grizz rocketing to the top of the tank rank, especially since the Suns won last night.
Can we take this 2 minutes and just have that be their section? I'll add in the stats for the 15 and 60.
Oh, man. Sadly, we already had Liam do the Grizz, so we can't just farm it out to him again.
No, he gets punishment like once every 3 weeks. I think that's only fair. Not more than that.
Well, it's not punishment. It's more like work evasion for us. But yeah, I mean, you get to the point now with a team like the Grizz, and like, they might have some young players we could take a little bit of a look at.
Absolutely. I'll watch Dylan Brooks and some other stuff.
Yeah, but nonetheless, like, I mean, it's just such a weird ecosystem and just where they're at this point that you question really how much can you learn. So we'll get to Cleveland and Philly momentarily here, but first this from Audible, and I was reminded again on this road trip that I took to Colorado just how awesome Audible is. And a lot of these books will come out on the exact same day that the normal books come out. In fact, when Jonathan Abrams' book On the Wire came out, that was like, oral histories are just like perfect for audiobooks too. And I was praying that the audiobook would come out the same day as the actual book did, because it was in the middle of our trip, and it did. And I've finished just about that whole book now in audio version. I've probably have listened to maybe 10 books or so, maybe even more than that, in the past year with Audible. I've been a subscriber there since 2005. I think especially for like sports books, it's really good, because those are the kind of books where you don't have to like really lock in and like think about it. And like, when the author spends like three pages describing a scene, you don't have to imagine it. Sports books don't have that. It's more just like quotes and facts and stuff. So it's similar kind of mental energy to listening to a podcast. And so those are great for audiobooks. Listen to Jack McCallum's book on audio. Listen to Loose Balls on audio. I listened to that Wire oral history. Listen to Jack McCallum's Dream Team book on audiobooks. It was all within probably the last 3 or 4 months I've done this. And it's great. Even if you're washing the dishes or something, it's awesome. So the way to get started with Audible and get your 30-day trial and your first audiobook free, go to audible.com/capspace, or you could text capspace to the number 500-500. audible.com/capspace. Easy to remember that, because we talk about capspace all the time on the program. audible.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. So this game started with the news 2 hours or so before tip-off that, quote, something happened after shoot-around per Ty Lue that led to J.R. Smith receiving a one-game suspension, although they were extremely adamant that he'll be back at practice on Friday and would start again on Saturday. What the hell could have happened after shoot-around with J.R. Smith? They claim that it's not an altercation with another player or something. I mean, I can't even begin to think of what this was, but just so weird.
However, it did give us an opportunity to see Rodney Hood as the starting shooting guard, which was, I don't even necessarily call it a silver lining. It was better than that because it was just something I wanted to see. This was not the best game for Rodney Hood, though I think a portion of that was more just the shots not falling rather than him playing particularly badly. I'm not sure if you disagree with that.
Yeah, Hood was effective early against J.J. Redick, using his size to maneuver into short-range shots, rise up over the top of Redick, who's one of the shorter-arm players in the NBA, doesn't have a lot of explosion, obviously, and so Hood was able to get to his shot at 6'8". It looked to be effective early, but then did not have the shots go down. He missed a very key three late off of a timeout that really could have made things interesting. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, what do you think, just assuming that J.R. Smith and Rodney Hood kind of play the way we expect them to play the rest of the season, who do you think should start?
I think that Hood is a natural fit, just getting some of those minutes, and maybe you can get him activated a little bit more. And both of them are so inconsistent defensively that I actually think the biggest factor there is who checks out more by being on the bench. And I'm guessing that might be J.R. Smith, which is the reason why I'd probably end up starting him.
It's really interesting to me. I mean, J.R. is what, 32, 33 right now? Like, usually guys will grow, and he's had some moments, obviously, with this Cavs team of increasing maturity, but like 32 or 33 year old guys, like, don't just like get suspended for a game. You know, like, that's very odd to see that, you know, when you're talking about like guys who are 22 or 25 or something, that'll happen. And you wonder about Smith. Hopefully, we won't learn after this season or at some point in his future that he was like going through some more personal demons than maybe could have been expected at this point, and that maybe has something to do with why he hasn't had the season that I think people would have expected from him. I'm in agreement. I think you go with Smith still, but they also, with Korver and with Hood, Smith is probably the best defensive option of those three guys, although he's not great himself, and he's not going to play great right now, then, you know, he is somewhat expendable.
And that's, I think, more of an off-season concern than a regular season thing. I think you roll with him while you have him right now.
But I mean, the question comes at some point, though, especially in the playoffs, especially if you get down in a playoff series, of, all right, how long are we going to roll with this guy as opposed to just going with guys who might be more effective? The number one thing that stuck out to me from this game, and there are a lot of things, but the number one thing to me was I thought the Sixers, as has happened to many a Cavs opponent this season, including the Spurs when they won at the Cavs about a week ago, just beat them with athleticism and effort and just getting to key loose balls really throughout the game. There are a couple of big rebounds late, one where Redick, who's not like some great athlete, but he beat two Cavs to a tip out rebound by Joel Embiid and then got fouled and got to the free throw line. Robert Covington got a big defensive rebound. There's a play in the first quarter where Robert Covington just dove on the ground. I think it was Hood that he just took the ball away from. Hood did not get down on the floor and really make much effort to get to the ball. And, you know, they'll play Osman, they'll play Tristan Thompson, but they just don't radiate effort the way a young, hungry team like the Sixers did. And I thought that was the biggest difference tonight more than anything.
Along those lines, something that I was thinking about is how they're going to have to balance the Larry Nance, Tristan Thompson dynamic on this team, because Tristan has a higher defensive ceiling. I mean, we saw what he did back in the 2016 finals. He was essential for how Cleveland succeeded in that series. But he is not enough for the lineups that they're considering. And this was, I would say, I think they got back in transition better. Overall, this wasn't a great defensive performance for Cleveland. Tristan Thompson does not make them good enough defensively that I think you really need to prioritize playing him for that purpose. Nance, I like his chemistry with LeBron. I think that LeBron also activates because he's such a good passer. He activates a lot more of Nance's gravity than the other guys do because opponents know that he can get Nance the ball, and that's very important. So I think they should consider that, but do you risk blowing up that part of the chemistry when you already know that Kevin Love is coming back and you're going to get into a holding pattern and a whole bunch of adjustment then? Do you just kind of roll with it now, see where it goes, and then say, okay, when Kevin Love gets back, we're going to have to reshuffle the deck anyway. Let's take this information and just wait.
Yeah, they did in fact close with Nance. Those two, Thompson and Nance, alternated all of the minutes at center. They did not go matched up as they were against Joel Embiid with any of the Jeff Green / LeBron at center units. Thompson played 22 minutes, Nance 20. 26. Nance had 13 points and was plus one. Thompson was negative 12, although he did have an effect on the offensive glass with six offensive boards. Was not really able to finish around the rim with Embiid there, though. And you would think that, hey, it's Embiid. Thompson is their best post defender. We would go with Embiid. But Embiid just went right through Tristan Thompson to a couple of early fouls, getting deep post position. I mean, Thompson can guard nearly anybody in the league in the post, but Embiid was just too much for him. So I think they just decided they wanted to go with the better offensive player in Nance. Nance able to move his feet at least maybe better than this version of Tristan Thompson can. I thought Nance did an okay job on Joel, who ended up going 7 of 18 from the field and struggled at the line as well, only 3 of 8, although Embiid hit a huge shot late. I thought another key thing here, and this is another thing that the Sixers were able to do well, J.J. Redick was unbelievable, and his activity and movement and shooting ability, the Cavs do not really have the communication or the lockdown, lock and trail type of defender to deal with Redick's movement, and so he had 22 points on only 11 shots, actually uncharacteristically missed two free throws. He could have been even better, and was plus 17 for the game. And I love, Danny, some of the sets that they ran for Redick late that really got him wide open.
They're also getting better at finding him off of those loose ball kind of offensive rebounds. There was one where it went to, I think it went to Amir Johnson, I'm trying to remember who it went to, and then Redick just cut to exactly the right spot. They got him in the ball and he just drilled the shot. And that's something I've gotten more attuned to with Steph Curry, because he is very good at that too. Korver is actually really good at that as well, and LeBron is great at finding him, but it takes time to really think about playing with somebody like that, because there aren't that many players who can just get to the right spot that quickly in the league.
In the last 5 minutes of the game, they had two beautiful ATOs to get Redick open. One was Redick setting a back screen for Ben Simmons with Embiid holding it at the elbow, and then sprinting off of a DHO from Embiid, getting a wide open three. And then the other one, which I liked even more, and this is a play that I think at this point I'm starting to see it proliferate a little bit. The Warriors have done it a couple times with Klay Thompson. I don't know if it was just impromptu or not. And then the Sixers run this pretty regularly now with Redick, is get the ball into the post and then actually have your great shooter set a screen. I mean, if you're at that close a range, you have to help on that screen. And there's nothing else you can do if a guy like Embiid just takes one dribble, and if his man is screened off, if you don't help on that, then he's just going to roll right in for a dunk. So you have to help. And then when that happens, Redick can just sprint to the corner. They actually did a decent enough job closing out on him, and Redick was still able to elude the defender and hit a key baseline jump shot that iced it, I thought. Really nice stuff there from the Sixers against a Cavs team that, as we know, struggles in a lot of aspects of defense.
I also had an appreciation, which I get pretty frequently with the Sixers, of Ben Simmons' size. You know, LeBron still can bounce off of damn near everybody in the league, but there were a couple times where Simmons looked like he bothered him a little bit, and that is just different.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see that very often. LeBron still was spectacular in a lot of this game. 30 points on 26 shooting possessions, 9 rebounds, 8 assists, and only 3 turnovers. Yeah, this was a very low turnover game for both teams, and that was actually more important for the Sixers, because they're way worse at that than the Cavs are.
Yeah, Cleveland doesn't have a lot of guys who force
turnovers. That's also true, and that would be a problem for them in the playoffs. But I thought that Simmons, just his physicality in that way, and you think about what he could be after a couple more years, not only of strength and conditioning and just getting a better body in that way, but just understanding how he fits within an NBA offense and defense, and where he can press those advantages, it'll be even more noticeable than it is now. Because let's say the Covington Embiid Simmons trio is together for another 4 years, I think they'll get these dynamics together way better than they are right now, and they've been great broadly defensively this year.
Yeah, I really thought that Simmons, you mentioned his moments on LeBron, he at 6'10", he doesn't have the longest arms, but a lot of defending LeBron is not really about length. I think it's more about just being able to stay in front and not get knocked backwards. And Simmons, he's not as strong as LeBron, but he has enough heft to just at least continue to compete. And he also has great anticipation, and he plays with pretty good effort. I mean, he had a couple of steals of entry passes to LeBron. He almost had another one that somehow just snaked through that led to a three, but it was a good gamble for the steal. He was right there. And another play that I thought was really interesting was LeBron in transition, you know, was pretty under control, went to a spin move, and usually whoever is on him will just get knocked back under the basket. And Simmons was able to hold his ground well enough and then strip LeBron on that play. And, you know, maybe LeBron, you know, his fellow clutch sports teammate, he wasn't going
1,000 miles an hour in this game. He didn't strike me that way necessarily, especially on offense. But I thought Simmons at least had some moments here. I'm not going to say he's going to shut him down in the playoffs. And he didn't even have the primary assignment, too. A lot of that was Robert Covington, who I thought had a wonderful game. But his energy, too, I mean, just had a key play where he denied LeBron and forced Kyle Korver to try to drive from the center circle all the way to a layup against Embiid, where he got stopped. So again, it was just that Sixers youth energy. And then finally, Joel with that icing shot where he faced up on Nance, went to the spin move, Dirk fadeaway, Clarkson tried to go double, and it didn't matter. He just hit this incredible fadeaway shot on the baseline to put it away.
This was also a big game in terms of minutes, for the new additions on the Sixers. Bellinelli played 23 minutes. Ilyasova played 18, having just signed earlier in the day. And neither one of them was great. Ilyasova got, I would call it a charge and a half, because he drew one charge, and the other one, they called it a turnover. They just didn't go either way, but if he hadn't been standing there, it wouldn't have been a turnover. I still hate the way the rule is called, but he does a nice job of maximizing it in that way. Bellinelli we haven't done the Sixers since he got there on Twitter NBA show, but there will be moments where I just go off because he takes some of the worst shots in the league, just fading twos, all sorts of weird crap, but he's such a good cutter. I think that can really provide some value, and when he's engaged defensively, he tries a little bit, and that's nice. And the Sixers just, they needed one more guy on the perimeter, and then Ilyasova, I think he's just a better power forward option. We talked about that a little bit earlier in this show and previously. So they're not perfect players. They're not, I don't think they're a part of the Sixers rotation going forward or anything like that, but having capable stewards that it seems like Brett Brown trusts adds meaningful depth and allows them to play in a game against a quality opponent. And Simmons and Embiid, both those guys did not play more than 34 minutes.
Yeah, Simmons perhaps in part due to the fact he had five fouls. Covington was up at 41 actually, but everyone else was 34 minutes or fewer. Ilyasova is just such a smart help defender. I mean, I don't really care for his game. He does a lot of flopping. You know, we hate charges, all that. But he does get those charges because he knows where to be. He's got a great eye for understanding when he can help. He was guarding a guy like Jeff Green. And he didn't really get taken advantage of. Green didn't really do anything in this game. He was 1 out of 6. And one play that really encapsulated it was Cleveland ran an ATO where they had LeBron James in the post. They had Kyle Korver back screening, which is so tough to deal with for, I think I want to say it was Jeff Green, and Ilyasova knew exactly what was coming, stepped in front of Green and was able to get a deflection that then went out of bounds to the Sixers. That's just the type of play that he is capable of making. And a few other notes here before we depart. Embiid, 6 offensive rebounds tonight. That is one thing that I think he could get much better at, and Liam remarked on this in the 15 and 60 that Embiid looks to be in a little bit better a shape in terms of his effort than he had been, and I think we saw some of that because he was really beasting guys in the offensive glass. He's only has an 8% offensive rebound rate, and given his physical tools, I mean, he could be one of the absolute best offensive rebounders in the league. He spends more time in the perimeter trying to score. He's got a lot of responsibilities, so I don't begrudge him that, but if he could get the energy up to get onto the offensive glass, I mean, he could really cause problems. And then he, unlike Tristan Thompson, when Embiid gets the offensive rebound, he's going to score, you know, or he's going to get a great tip in, and he had quite a few second chance points in this one. I got a couple more notes, but anything else you wanted to go on?
It was a reminder. I've said this for basically the entire year. The best thing you can do against Joel Embiid offensively is make him dribble. And he just gets in some trouble. Sometimes he gets stripped, those kind of things. He's getting a little bit better. I think he's getting a little bit tighter, but he's so much less dangerous there than even shooting or getting there. Because sometimes he makes reckless passes. So I would be focused more on that really at this point. Don't be ready to dare him to drive, because he's not going to beat you as often that way.
And that's the Sixers did, I thought, do a nice job of getting him to put it on the floor and then coming at the right time once he'd taken a dribble or two and wasn't in a great position to pass it. And they did not let him, like Nance did a good job of this, they wouldn't let him just face up and take that jumper, which as we've talked about before, is totally deadly. So I thought they did an okay job on him. And I didn't think that overall, especially in the second half, at times the Cavs D was that bad, but they got beaten in transition every once in a while, or they'd make a few mistakes. Like a key segment of the game was, I think they either tied it or got within two, and on a great play where they had another ATO, where they had Nance fake a screen for LeBron. The Warriors run the same play a lot with Draymond Green, where they fake the screen for the ball handler and then instead go get the shooter on a wide pin down out of the corner, and they got Korver wide open. He was being guarded by Šarić, and Šarić is not a guy who's going to be able to get through screens on a guy like Korver. And then Simmons comes back down. Cleveland blows an on-ball switch between Hood and Clarkson, and that forced help, and then they got Šarić a wide open corner three right back within like 5 seconds because they blew that switch. And that was, we've seen a lot of those in that Spurs game as well. We saw a lot of those still miscommunications from Cleveland that, you know, they would say that, oh, well, you know, they'll get it figured out once these new guys get acclimated, but you know, it's been some time now. And there's certainly some guys, you know, Ersan Ilyasova came back in with the Sixers team. Yeah, I know he played here before, but he didn't miss a beat. You know, he didn't make any mistakes like that in his first game with the team. And then I thought that LeBron, the way he was guarding TJ McConnell was like pretty hilarious.
Yeah, TJ McConnell's reluctance and ineffectiveness shooting threes is going to be a big problem, especially in the playoffs when teams figure this out, because LeBron was basically giving him like 8 feet of clearance, if not more.
He might have been standing at the dotted line, and
it was amazing.
McConnell took two threes right in a row, and I don't know whether LeBron left the game after that or they just didn't go back to McConnell. He missed both threes, and then later in the second half, McConnell hit a mid-ranger over LeBron, and then the second time LeBron still wasn't really guarding him, and then kind of surprised him with a contest late. So he ended up going 1 out of 4 basically against that strategy. But it was pretty, I mean, and it was funny too, because LeBron himself has faced that strategy, most notably by Greg Popovich, a lot of the time. And clearly, I mean, McConnell, although he shot the ball well on threes, this is one of those ones where it's like, okay, his percentage versus the reality are two different things.
I could respond to that, but I feel like all my responses would get me into trouble with fan bases that are already mad at us for things we said yesterday.
All right, I think that will do it for today. Don't forget to check out audible.com/capspace. Get that first month and a free audiobook as well. And we'll be back 15 and 60 style. Yeah, what?
You guys, before that, I have a piece to plug. Yeah, I do.
Ah, yes, good.
So I wrote for The Athletic on an idea that I had like 2 months ago and just finally got around to writing it, about KJ McDaniels and Jeremy Grant, two guys that were drafted in the top 10 of the second round in 2014. Jeremy Grant took the Hinkie Special, the 4-year lightly guaranteed contract. KJ McDaniels took the qualifying offer, and just kind of how that played out for those two guys. It's up for The Athletic Philadelphia, but any subscriber to The Athletic gets access to it. And I enjoyed it as an exercise and to go through it and just to track those paths, because I mean, KJ McDaniels has been on the Grand Rapids Drive all year, and so it was checking in with him and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, that might be a good Danny story time actually, because McDaniels is just one of the most fascinating contractual situations over the last couple of years, and he's one of those guys who his greatest moments in the league were like the first month and a half of his career, which was too bad.
He's not the only Sixer for that to be true, former Sixer for that to be true.
All right, now we can call it quits. We'll be back with the 15 and 60 Western Conference on Sunday night. Talk to you all then.